He takes us to his childhood memories, through the cemetery, the sweet spot, the dead store, the drive-in car culture, recalling his mentor, Jake Murray, his friendly auction bidder friend, Truman Capote, and, of course, lives an adventurous childhood with his exceptionally witty mother, Pat, his crazy, charming dad, Larry, whom he dedicates this book to, and his fabulous sister, Meg. The Hamptons were his playground. And he was still and is the kid in the long-lost kingdom. I remain George Miller, along with my wife and co-host, and Kate Scuffle, and we bring you, I almost forgot her name, oh boy, am I in trouble, and we will bring you the this special program. This is WDIY 88.1 FM in Allentown, and you are our listening guests here on Lehigh Valley Art Salon. Of course, our guest and journalist, arts writer and commentator, theater lover, and all-around good friend of the Lehigh Valley is Jeff Gaiman. And later, curator of the Bethlehem Fine Arts Commission self-portrait exhibition, Vince Gentilcore, and Charles Cantalupo, the writer, share with us a unique insight into the participants of the sense of self. And, of course, the sense of self, in many ways, is the subject of this fabulous book called The Kingdom of the Kid.
Growing up in the long-lost Hamptons.
Yes.
So,
welcome.
Thank you. Good to be saloning with you, my friends.
I'm wondering, you know, I would have only seen the Hamptons as an adult. The Hamptons we think of today, the exclusive playground of wealthy and perhaps frivolous folks. But Jeff, among many things that the book is, it's also a kind of snapshot or a revisiting of the Hamptons you knew. The long lost. Tell us a little bit about that, about Waynescott.
Well, I grew up in Waynescott, which is a hamlet between Bridgehampton and East Hampton, in the Hamptons on the furthermost eastern end of Long Island. When I was growing up there in 67 to 72, we used to call it the South Fork or the East End. The Hamptons is still a kind of a too glitzy term for me. Uh-huh. But my parents built a four-bedroom, two-bath colonial home in Waynescott for $21,000, including land, in 1967. And that same house would go for $2 million today. Mm. That tells you how things have changed. Waynescott had about 500 folks back in the late 60s. Beautiful beach, potato fields, woods of scrub oak, a one-room school, a one-room post office, a general store that was dead that I kind of resurrected with my imagination, had a rusty Coca-Cola sign, and that made me think seriously about what it was like when it was a beehive. You had, because it was the Hamptons, you had all sorts of unusual combinations of folks. A plumber lived across the street from this two-bedroom antebellum Kentucky mansion owned by Estée Lauder.
Oh, my gosh.
It was down the street, down Main Street, from a farm that was owned by the Osbournes, who came to the east end of Long Island in the last part of the 17th century.
Oh, my.
And further down the road was a cottage rented by Paul McCartney's brother-in-law one summer. And a bunch of Waynescotteers listened to Paul McCartney, newly separated from the Beatles, plucking guitar on a screened-in porch. So it was this wonderful place that was just full of freedom and fun. In fact, too much freedom for any kid to bear.
Mm-hmm. You do mention in the end of the book, it's hard writing about your life more than 40 years after it's been lived. But you've done fabulously because you've taken me right to that time.
Well, I've always been the historian of my family. I grew up with a dad who I describe as a boozing, schmoozing social bulldozer. Who took me around to a lot of places. He was the guy who took me to the Bridgehampton Race Circuit, where Mario Andretti met Paul Newman, and where all these great race drivers race this, you know, crazy track with dunes and a beautiful view. And he took me to the Long Island Automotive Museum, which was owned by a crazy proprietor named Austie Clark, who one time had more classic cars than anybody in the world. My dad taught me how to throw a curveball, introduced me to Kari Ostremski, who is my baseball hero, who grew up in Bridgehampton. I spent a lot of time by the Ostremski home. That was partly why I remembered this era so clearly, because it was so indelible to me. But, you know, 40 years is 40 years, so I had to go back and do the microfilming of the East Hampton Star, the weekly paper that made me want to be a journalist. I interviewed a lot of my old friends. I interviewed people who made my childhood special, people who as a kid I didn't really talk to or pay attention to. The one person I just have to speak about who made me partly write this book is named June Morris, and she was a co-owner with her husband, Harvey, of the Penny Candy Shop Watermill. And Penny Candy Shop, the place where you got your, you bit off the button candies from the strips, where you bit the tops off the wax bottles to drain the liquid, and where everybody learned to smoke cigarettes by waving the chalky candy cigarettes, which made you feel like an adult. June Morris is still alive. I actually just talked to her yesterday. She's read the book. It actually, she says, helped her out of a long convalescence in the hospital. And that's exactly what I want to hear. This book is to make people who live that era remember it well and vividly.
And it sounds like it must have been a powerful experience to go back as an adult. As an adult, not a child now, and re-meet or talk to these people as an adult now, and share with them that this was, that they were that important to you.
It was very significant. It was very moving. One of the most moving chapters is about my first writing coach and first sex coach too. thanks, Mom. his name was Jake Murray. He lived a street across from us in Waynescott. He was an advertising man turned novelist. He had a best-selling, at least best-selling out there, novel in 69 called The Devil Walks on Water, a crazy class-conscious book set during the 38 hurricane in Southampton. And Jake Murray was the sort of guy that every kid, especially boy, really needs when he's growing up. He had this wonderful cabana-style house studio. On the deck, he had four seats from Ebbets Field, the Brooklyn Dodgers' old stadium. Jake was a crazy Brooklyn Dodgers fan. He would tell Mike Raffel, my best friend and baseball lover, and myself these stories about the old Brooklyn Dodgers. While we sat in the seats from Brooklyn, from Ebbets Field, while we drank bottles of Pepsi, and if we were really good, he'd let us peer at his Playboys. So once again, I had to write this book to pay tribute to folks like that. Going back and interviewing Jake's family members, his children, his stepchildren, his first wife, my friends, made me realize why this manic depressive alcoholic tragic fellow meant so much to me.
Yes.
He helped make me a writer, among other things.
And that's why you dedicated the book, I think, to him.
Well, actually, I dedicated it to my dad.
Yes. Oh, to your dad,
Of course. Yeah. But he was also a crazy, manic, depressive, alcoholic guy who the biggest mystery is why Jake Murray and my dad, who lived a street apart in Waynescott, who had many mutual friends, I never understood why they were never friends. I can't even remember one time when they were together. It's a mystery that will have to remain. You can't answer everything, no matter if you spend 22 years working on a book or not.
And was going, I'm just thinking, too, for a father, though, a complicated parent who is now no longer with us. This would, I think, would also be a kind of journey back to revisiting that and
making, you better believe it. It could be the book could be called a subtitled pilgrimage, a family pilgrimage. I began it largely to make sense of this crazy, charming, complicated guy who could be the life of the party, led a barbershop quartet, told animal poems that would have made Ogden Nash blush,
and then
envy.
Sold the house without telling your mother.
Yeah, after 6 years of this bliss of childhood bliss in Waynescott, he needed money very badly. At this point, he'd already wasted my sister and my childhood tuition on a crazy scheme to turn a Montauk windmill into a conference center, and he needed money, so he sold the house without my mom's permission. Her name was not on the deed, ergo he could do that.
Right.
What happened with this book, just I'll give you one example of how I understood my dad better. In 1967, Kari Yastrzemski had a dream year with the Boston Red Sox. And out on the South Fork where he grew up, it was off the charts exciting. I'm a brand new baseball little leaguer. I have a baseball hero to follow. Through my dad, I'm meeting folks like Peter Mickney, who played high school baseball with Yaz. We're going into a restaurant owned by another high school baseball pal of Yaz's. And my dad picks up on this excitement. He knows this is the first time I have something, a cause outside myself. So what does my dad do? My dad was a great athlete. In the backyard of our wainscot home, he builds me a pitcher's mound of sand, dirt, two bricks for rubber. He buys a catcher's mitt with cigar coupons. He gets down an old gardening pillow to catch me. And throughout the summer of 1967, he was my catcher. I just saw one other thing about him that bonded me with him. We became much closer. Yeah. He would make me, he always had a martini glass by his left leg. And he dared me to not hit the martini glass while I was pitching to him. And I'm very proud to say that while I broke his toe with a pitch, I never broke the martini glass. But the chapter Yaz, Dad, and Me is all about that summer, that magical summer of 67, where a baseball player brought me much closer to my dad.
We've talked to a little bit about, wherever that one spends one's childhood, that you also feel that there's a particular portal, a time, a coming of age, that is branded on your memory, that things change.
Right.
That it's intense. It's a awakening.
The book is kind of universal because I've made this point over and over again. Everybody has that 6 month or 6 year period that changes their life forever and hopefully for good. This book I wrote partly to give my family and our friends pleasant memories of an often painful time. This is a time when the middle class got shoved out of the South Fork. Potato farmers had to sell their acreage to because their crops were diminishing, their returns were diminishing. Developers came in, built much more expensive homes, property values went up, taxes went up. Families like mine couldn't afford to live out there. So I just felt like I had to go back to this period that I knew was important. I didn't know exactly why it was important, and follow the journey, the 6 years where I got all my passions by dumb luck in one special place. Passion for driving movies, rock and roll.
Cars.
Fast cars, faster women. Yes, folks, there's sex in this book. Please buy it. My mom wasn't shocked. You won't be too. And class consciousness and writing. I became a writer out there, definitely.
Very good. You know, you mentioned that again at the very end of the book, and I've read the whole book, not just the
end. Thank you, George. You're a good friend.
That this was a time release capsule, or similar to a time release capsule, when you can open wherever and whenever you want to. And that's the glory of it, is it not?
You better believe it. As to continue that that sentence you just mentioned, I learned whenever there's a storm, I hear the ocean wind, and I got it out there. Whenever privet blossoms release their perfume in the spring, I think of the hedges out there. You know, privet hedges are endemic to the Hamptons. They are a symbol. Whenever I taste a slice of coconut watermelon candy, I think of the Penny Candy Shop. And the crazy thing is Andrew Wyeth has this painting called Her Room.
Yes.
A beautiful painting of a a window of a main home. It was his wife, his wife's room, and the window's open, the lace curtains are blowing. Whenever I see that painting, I think of the room where I almost lost my virginity.
Okay.
That's how powerful
that
this six-year period was.
That is certainly powerful. I'd love to speak with you more and more about the East Hampton newspaper, but I would like you, if you would please, to read just a little portion of your book.
I will. This is very, very happy to. One of the sort of universal quintessential subjects in the book is the drive-in movie, mm-hmm. the Hamptons drive-in in Bridgehampton, and I start the chapter this way. I'm lying under a blanket in the back seat of our 1964 Chevy Impala, snoring through 2001, A Space Odyssey, a blisteringly boring film for an 11-year-old who hates science fiction. Sleeping is my only escape from an incomprehensible, insufferable cast of actors dressed as prehistoric apes, screaming at an anachronistic monolith, astronauts babbling about a mission to the moon, and a droning, lullabying computer with a superiority complex. I'm jolted awake by a racket rattling the loudspeaker wedged into the driver's side window. The screeching comes from a space pod rocketing beyond infinity, the only exciting scene in a movie that Mad, my favorite funny magazine, dubbed 2001 A Space Idiocy. Drowsiness becomes disorientation as stars explode, colored lights erupt, space haywires, and my brain bobsleds through a psychedelic Times Square plugged into Jimi Hendrix's amplifier.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful.
That's all about a virtual acid trip at a drive-in, which was always fun, even when the movie sucked.
Yeah. How vivid. Almost as vivid as a magnificent picture that you have back in the Thanks, Incorporated page, which is of your mother, Pat Gaiman, on the beach, looking like a model, certainly, in Wedgecut. The Hamlet between the Hamptons. And what that is, a magnificent picture. Pat, we love you out there. We know you're there.
Gathering photos for the book was a great joy. The book, writing the book was a great joy.
Yeah.
Gathering photos was a community collaboration. Got them from old friends and new friends. And finding that old shot from my mom's scrapbook for my sister was a joy also.
The other thing I love about the book, when you open it up, there is a page or two, actually an open flyleaf, that has a map on it. And I said, what is that map? Can you tell us what that map is?
The map is an old, first came out in the 1930s, a map of Long Island. It was in my childhood bedroom in Waynescott. It's a very colorful folk map. And I found it 2 years ago in a bric-a-brac shop in Montgomery County, and just had to reproduce it in the book.
Wow. That's wonderful. We want you to mention, too, that there will be a book signing.
Yep. Folks, come out, see me, talk to me, hear a bit about the stories. 1 to 3 p.m., July 28th, at the Moravian Bookshop, our hometown bookstore.
Well, that's been wonderful.
And you'll be being interviewed and profiled?
Nope, just me.
No, you're going to be interviewed and profiled up in...
Oh, actually, the book tour officially starts this weekend in the Hamptons.
Yes.
Where I will have three events. You can check my Facebook page and other people's Facebook page, including SUNY Press, my publisher, to find out about that. Other dates in the Hamptons in August and September, too.
Jeff Gaiman, we love you. Thank you for this fantastic book.
Congratulations.
It's done several things to me. Thank you very much. And we will be returning in a brief digital moment with Vince Gentilcore of the Bethlehem Fine Arts Commission, and Charles Cantalupo, a writer. We'll be right back after this salient message.
WDIY is proud to partner with The Seed Farm, presenting Sowing Seeds, Bike Ride, and Run Walk, Saturday, July 20th at The Seed Farm, 5854 Vera Cruz Road South, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Cyclists and runners of all levels are invited to participate and support the work of The Seed Farm while biking, running, or walking through some of the Lehigh Valley's scenic farmland. For more information, 610-391-9583 or theseedfarm.org.
Ah, that was wonderful, talking to Jeff Gaiman, the author of his new book, The Kingdom of the Kid. Here's something that's wonderful as well. I can speak for my wife and myself that is we are a part of. With us here is Vince Gentilcore of the Bethlehem Fine Arts Commission and Charles Cantalupo, who is a writer, to tell us about certainly this new exhibition. Hi, welcome.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi.
Vince, tell us a little bit about the show is titled Reflections, a self-portrait show, and this isn't the first version.
No,
of it,
this is not the first. This is the second. I went to the opening in 2011 of the first show at the Rotunda, mm-hmm. and I know Richard read through the local arts community, mm-hmm. and was fascinated by the topic and the concept, and really enjoyed myself, saw what the non-artist did and the artist at the time. So when they approached Richard about curating the next show, which was last summer, he said, I'd rather not curate it, but I'll participate. And then he turned around and looked at me and said, would you be interested in curating? And I said, sure. I'm interested in the arts, performing arts, visual arts, and I thought it would be a great opportunity to make a contribution to the community.
And one of the interesting things about the show, for instance, actually George and I, in the interest of full disclosure, do have pieces hanging in the show. We would be not traditionally known as visual artists at all. We'd be theater artists, etc. Charles, we were talking earlier, you're a writer, a published writer, whatever, but not a visual artist.
No, I'm not a visual artist, but certainly one of my most important principles in writing is for writing to be visual, okay. No matter what you're writing. But I was able to kind of subvert this visual art idea by using the covers of 10 of my 12 books while I've been in Bethlehem, and also adding an excerpt to that by having a little computer chip and a 1-minute audio, mm-hmm. in which I'd be reading from each book, because really, while the cover is who I am, when I get more information from within the cover itself,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in the book, that is.
And I should clarify that while we're talking about this, Charles has a piece. This is your piece that's hanging in the show at the Rotunda.
Yes.
And it's interesting to me, a lot of the non-visual artists have a really eclectic approach to self-portraits, much like yours. It's not a traditional line drawing of your face or a sketch of you. Vince, are you surprised by what comes in?
Not this time around, yeah. Although I was delighted by what the non-artists contributed. There's always the great unknown, the fact that they're not known as artists,
yeah.
What they're going to provide. And they came up with very interesting, unique pieces of art, many of which were interpretive, not necessarily mm-hmm. Traditional, realistic. And they range a varied media from painting, prints, drawings, collage, assemblage. Previous show, there was a wall sculpture. So it's, I wasn't surprised. The media is quite varied, very interesting, very engaging, and very emotional. It's very powerful mm-hmm. when you look at the work that was done. And although most non-artists were somewhat reserved about participating, they agreed mm-hmm. and found it very challenging to try to express their inner self.
Yeah, as a non-visual artist, but still as an artist, you know, visual artists make portraits of people all the time. And I tried to do that with my work because certainly it's important to know that we find out our own stories, the portraits of ourselves, whether it's our inner portrait or outer portrait, by knowing the stories of others. And so a lot of my books, for example, they're about Africa. I'm an American. A lot of my books translate other poets. I have my own books of poetry. A lot of my books are about other writers. But I also learn from those stories. I mean, really, mm-hmm. everybody on the street outside of the studio has a story. And if only we could know it, we'd probably have a lot more respect for human beings.
That's a really interesting thought, because I was surprised walking around looking at the show, how, although you would call it non-traditional perhaps in terms of a self-portrait, how moving many of the pieces were in terms of people I thought I knew, and seeing other sides or other bits or elements or tones to them that was like, oh.
I think we really owe that to this man next to me. Vince has a way of bringing out people. I have seen it in non-artistic circumstances. We'd be at the YMCA where we first met, or certainly when you see that show. Somehow, I don't know what you do, Vince, but you really do bring people out, and that's a gift.
Incidentally, we want to mention that our listeners can tell their friends to get to see this self-exhibition at the Rotunda.
Rotunda Gallery at City Hall in Bethlehem, and it runs through
August 26th.
I thought so. So
Monday
the end of the summer,
Friday,
really.
8:30 to 4:30.
Okay.
There are 32 different exhibits, 16 artists, 16 non-artists.
Okay.
And quite a variety of non-artists from educators, musicians, students, political leaders, religious leaders, business leaders, many different.
I was going to say, it's really kind of an exciting snapshot of the community. Yeah. It really is.
Well, we thank you both for being here today, and we look forward to coming to the exhibition and for the great work that you're doing at the Bethlehem Fine Arts Commission.
We
also want to say special thanks to Steve Aronson, our favorite novelist, engineer, and painter of the radio wave, for his exemplary work in keeping our voices brisk and hopefully pleasant.
Can you make that visual?
Yes. Thank you, Steve.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, at the movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistein of The Press.
The zombie apocalypse is upon us, and it's called World War Z. That's Z as in zombie. And the only person standing between us and the end of the world as we know it is Brad Pitt, who portrays a former United Nations official called back into service and tasked to find the antidote to the zombie pandemic. World War Z is not as funny as Zombieland, the 2009 zombie horror film spoof starring Woody Harrelson, Jesse Eisenberg, and Emma Stone, nor is World War Z as frightening as 28 Days Later, the 2002 Danny Boyle-directed film. World War Z is also not, thankfully, as graphic or bloody as the aforementioned zombie movies, nor many of those zombie movies in the genre. World War Z is less a zombie film and more of an apocalypse or end-of-the-world movie, recalling War of the Worlds, a 2005 film directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Tom Cruise. Mark Forster directs World War Z. He directed Quantum of Solace, The Kite Runner, and Monster's Ball. He directs with an appropriate sense of urgency. The screenplay is by Matthew Michael Carnahan, who did the screenplays for State of Play and Lions for Lambs. It's also written by Drew Goddard, who did the screenplays for The Cabin in the Woods and Cloverfield, and Damon Lindelof, who did the screenplay for Star Trek Into Darkness. The screen story is based on the book An Oral History of the Zombie War, written by Max Brooks, a son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. A sense of dread is created, augmented by the terror facing Jerry Lane, played by Brad Pitt, in World War Z, the former UN official, and his wife, Karen Marielle Enos, along with their two daughters, who first confront the conflagration during a traffic jam in Philadelphia. The schoolgirl has never seen anything like this. Jerry's quest to find the origin of the zombie pandemic and possibly its antidote takes him to South Korea, Israel, and finally to a World Health Organization research center in Wales. That's where Jerry gets down to business and also where the screenplay bogs down. Fortunately, the storyline picks up again. World War Z is the feel-good zombie movie of the summer. World War Z provides Brad Pitt, who we know from Moneyball, Inglourious Basterds, and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, with one of his most varied roles. He moves easily from concerned father to action hero. The casting of the secondary character seems to be an intentional downplaying of those surrounding Pitt. Zombie films have a cinematic tradition going back to George A. Romero's 1968 genre setting, Night of the Living Dead. It's still uncertain what their place is in the pop culture zeitgeist. Suffice it to say that World War Z is in the tradition of a good old-fashioned scary summer movie. World War Z is MPAA rated PG-13 for intense, frightening zombie sequences, violence, and disturbing images. Opening July 5th, The Lone Ranger. Gore Verbinski directs the oft-told Western legend of John Reed, a.k.a. the Lone Ranger, played by Armie Hammer, from the point of view of Native American Tonto, played by Johnny Depp. Helena Bonham Carter and Tom Wilkinson co-star. Despicable Me. The Minions are back. Gru is recruited by the Anti-Villain League to deal with a new super criminal. Steve Carell, Kristen Wiig, Miranda Cosgrove, Russell Brand, and Ken Jeong are among the voice talents in the feature animation family comedy. The Way Way Back. A teenager experiences a rite of passage during a summer job at an amusement park in the comedy drama that stars Steve Carell, Amanda Peet, Maya Rudolph, Toni Collette, Allison Janney, and Anna Sophia Robb. I'm Paul Willistein of the Lehigh Valley Press at the movies for WDIY.